Thank you for tuning into the VF1 show with VF and Vincenzo, the podcast that discusses all things business, marketing, politics, and government within the world of Formula One. If that's your thing, then you found the right place. So without further ado, it's lights out and away we go.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the VF1 podcast. I'm Vincenzo with my wonderful co-host, VF, V and V. I always like just saying that is just so awesome, right? There's like another V that likes Formula One, and we have a show called VF1. We've got a long list of things to talk about today. We've got some exciting stuff early on. The new cars dropped. That's fun. But we also have deeper conversations to have here. Piggybacking off of last week's show, we've got more gatekeeping in Formula One, this time by the president or the CEO of Formula One. What's going on there? We have a question from a friend of the show about F1 Las Vegas. And yeah, F1 versus the Super Bowl, a whole bunch of stuff to go into today. How you doing over there, V?
Great, actually. I stayed up all night watching the W14 release or waiting for it. And I have learned one thing, and this is nothing against our European friends out there, but they don't understand sarcasm. I had a couple people, I was commenting yesterday, it's really rude of Mercedes to have the car release at 3 a.m. And some people were commenting like, not everything, you Americans are so selfish. just a couple of little comments. And I'm just like, y'all don't understand sarcasm, do you? Like my version of rude, like when I say that's like really rude, it's more in like, it's a joke.
Did you watch Full House growing up by any chance?
I didn't. I wasn't allowed to watch TV. Weird.
Okay. All right. Well, I thought maybe that because you would be right in line with that age group that watched Full House. Yeah. You know, Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen. One of their taglines was "How rude," or maybe that wasn't Mary Kate and Ashley. It was one of the other characters of the show. Whatever it is. So that's why I made that comment. But it's really interesting.
Maybe that is where I got it from, but I don't know.
Whatever. Not a topic for this show. One of the things that I just mentioned, actually, I might have even tweeted it, I don't know, but or I said it to somebody, was that I give Ferrari and Mercedes a lot of credit for sticking to their guns and having their launches at European centric times. Everyone else, I say everyone else. Now I have to go and like really think about it. Williams launch, obviously Red Bull, AlphaTauri was at a very strange, that was very weird overall. But those are all, you know, American or U.S. centric times for the launches to happen. And, you know, these two big guns in the sport decide, you know what, we're going to do ours at a time that's good for Europeans, and we're going to do it. And I thought they were the two best launches. In my opinion, they were the two really well done, livery or car. Actually, they were straight up, at least the Ferrari one was a straight up car reveal because they drove it onto the track right after they showed it off, which was freaking cool. Let's just jump in and talk a little bit about the cars and which one you like the best. Like, what did you like the best? Which one didn't you like the best? We've seen them all except for technically Alpine, which got leaked a couple days ago, potentially. At least this is what all of my livery designer friends say, that this is the leak. It got leaked. So based on everything that we know and see, which one do you like the best except, you know, not including Mercedes, cause you're a Mercedes fan. So if you take away Mercedes, which one did you like the best and which one did you not like? Or which one did you hate the most? I don't know. However I want to put that. Best and worst from you.
Best and worst. Okay. So we know, obviously, Mercedes. And okay, listen, I get why a lot of teams are going towards the matte carbon fiber. It's to reduce the weight of the car. That car is heavy, bitch. But I understand that completely. But I, for those who don't know, wear only black. Black is my favorite color. So anything that is done in black, I'm immediately like, immediately, yes. immediately yes. Like I want it like 10 of them. So that's just without question. I want everything in black. And so that's why that car, it just screamed like the Darth Vader theme song, just like the Imperial March started playing in my head and I was so happy. But I will say that I think the runner up to that is the Aston Martin. That car looks good. And of course, we've made jokes in the past. I think all of Formula One has made jokes in the past that Aston Martin typically looks like previous teams' other cars. And I think that's kind of the running joke, but I really like that car. I will say I like the Williams too, although, and this kind of goes into my worst teams, I don't love how they release new liveries on show cars. I think it's more to showcase how cool the car looks or sponsors, et cetera. But I want to see the technical components, like you said, with Ferrari driving the car onto the track, with Mercedes taking it on a lap shortly after. I want to see the car. We want to kind of analyze things. And I think that's why I like cars where you can kind of get a good idea before testing of what it's actually going to look like.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it doesn't matter, right? That's my opinion is it doesn't matter. I don't really care what they show us. I get what the livery is for. These are not being put out there as car reveals, I guess. You get an overall sense sometimes of what they're trying to do, but we really don't know until they get on the track and they start testing. Which, again, in my opinion, where Formula One sits right now, post Drive to Survive world, we have this thing, this livery reveal that hypes up a particular audience, satisfies another audience, being sponsors and brands that are involved, right? They get a lot of show time or airtime. And then you have the actual, like at testing, then you have some real, like the nerds and the techies and the geeks that get to, and I don't mean any, I mean all of those lovingly because I love all that stuff, right? They get to geek out on the technical stuff at testing, right? You get 3 days of that or 6 days of that, whatever it might be. If you look at Red Bull wasn't even, like they didn't even call it a Formula One reveal or livery launch. It was a Red Bull season launch. You know, they talked about, they had extreme sport folks up there, which I think convolutes a lot of things. It's like, okay, just give us one damn launch, right? We don't need 15 different sports or 15 different things that you're doing to be on stage, right? I actually thought the Red Bull launch was one of the, I hate to say this, but I didn't think it was very good from an optics standpoint. Yes, they had the great, you know, Ford news, which was, I mean, it was kind of like a, everyone knew it, but they didn't really get into anything until like a half an hour in. Just looking at some of the numbers online, viewership numbers tanked by the time they introduced Daniel Ricciardo, which is weird because you figure he would be a big draw. He's the newest thing that's going on in that team, and they didn't bring him out till I think it was like a half an hour in, and they lost quite a bit of viewers. So that launch was eh. The car looks good. Don't get me wrong. Yes, it's boring and it's the same, but they're winning. So you really like, right now they're back to back. Well, they have the back to back drivers champion, and they have a championship winning car from last year in the constructors. But you know, the car is fine. It's a good looking car. I thought the best looking car outside, I really do think the Ferrari is absolutely gorgeous. I love the red hue they picked. Outside of them, though, I do really, really like the Mercedes a lot. I love the all black, mostly black car. It looks really cool. in a time where we're, you know, most of these cars now, it seems like cars are getting darker, right? There's not as much color on the cars because of this weight situation. I still think they did it the best, right? The Williams is darker, although the Williams looked better on track. Like I saw some shots of it on track and some video, and I was like, okay, it looks better, which was the same. I think that happened last year as well. It looked better on track. Like the blue got a little bit brighter. It popped a little bit more. So that was nice. But what I really liked about the Mercedes, the livery's great. Like the black is incredible. The way they played with the exposed carbon and black paint, or black, you know, black unpainted, or the painted parts of the car was, I love the numbers. I love that they went with the high vis numbers. I don't know if, and now I'm going to backtrack, but I don't know if any of the other teams went with like super high vis numbers for the drivers, but I like that the best, right? So on like the black car, you've got like these, I think Lewis's is what, the yellow, or it looks almost green, but it's like super high vis. That's awesome. It looks great. I'm very, very excited to see that car on the track. You know, it's not even a month away, or about a month away or so. So that'll be fun, fun to see for sure. But that was definitely my best. And yeah, I don't know, the worst, I don't know. Let's see. Probably, you know, the thing is, I don't hate the Haas, but I thought it was just kind of like, I think the sponsor logo kind of killed it for me, but I'm gonna go with that. I'm gonna go with Mercedes,
go with Haas.
And Haas as my least favorite.
Yeah, I'm not gonna disagree with the Haas, and here's why. I think what happened with Yuriy Kaly last year was quite shocking to a lot of Americans, being that is our American team. And just seeing the Russian flag essentially painted over an American car, like that did not sit well with a lot of people in the US, and rightly so. And then the war happened, and then Haas terminated its relationship with Yuriy Kaly because, there's a lot that we're not going to go into with that. But I didn't like the way that car looked from day one. And so this year I kind of expected a more, let's do, because they've got this now threat coming from Andretti GM. I mean, maybe it's a threat, maybe it's not. But I thought that maybe they would sort of absorb more of that, you know, Americana into the car. And so when they released the red, white, and black, I'm thinking to myself, oh, here we go again. You couldn't have done like a matte navy blue or something. And I get it. They're trying to. It's a smart choice to go with the darker paint or the exposed carbon fiber because of the weight concerns with the car. But, you know, again, if you're an American car, and that really is their identity in F1, they are the American team. Embrace that. Don't just let a sponsor completely take over the car every single time. Embrace where your car, where the company actually originates from, is, I think, my biggest knock on Haas.
Yeah, I can see that. I can understand that, or I can kind of see where you're going with that. I'll just leave it at that. I'll let you have your point. I don't want to add more to it. I think it's perfectly made.
But I will say also the Duracell branding on the roll hoop for the Williams.
On the airbox.
Fire. Yeah. Again, the airbox. That is fire. That looks.
And so it was there last year. I believe it was definitely there in Miami. Might have also been there in Austin. It didn't get a lot of love last year. There was some talk about it, right? When it first dropped, it was like when they signed Duracell. And I know there was a Duracell executive that mentioned something to me on LinkedIn, because I brought it up, and they were like, man, I'm surprised that people didn't realize that it was there last year. And I'm like, that leads me into our next part of the show, is the purpose of the livery launch. And that's what I said to the executive. I'm like, well, you know what? You weren't there in the livery launch last year. It was just kind of like it happened after the season started. And yeah, the you know, the responsibility is I think that that conversation is probably up for debate, but I would personally agree with you that, you know, I mean, the FTX thing last year is a perfect example, right? People actually like lost their money, but at the same time, investing in that asset was known to be so very volatile, right? So like, who actually has the responsibility there? Mercedes is a business. They obviously want to make money. They need sponsors, but there's also the aspect of, you know, how responsible are they to partner with? And I want to use the word ethical, and it works in FTX's case circumstance, and I think it also works in another Mercedes circumstance with the it was a construction company they had used a couple years back that was involved somehow with those the towers that had burnt down in London, the Grenfell towers. And they actually removed them off the car immediately, and they wrote a whole press release about it and how they wanted to make sure they aligned. So I think it is very important that values match, right? Seeing a company like Bang & Olufsen partner with Ferrari made a lot more sense to me than Bang & Olufsen with Williams, right? Nothing against Williams, but Ferrari to me means, you know, kind of luxury and quality, precision. And that's exactly what Bang & Olufsen stands for in the audio and visual space that they're in. So it's like, okay, that makes sense. You can see that. But when you start talking about other potential sponsors or sponsors that have that, I mean, I'm not saying that Ferrari is perfect either, right? You've got Mission Winnow, which we know that's basically Philip Morris in another, wearing another hat, basically. You know, you've got things like that. It's like, okay, is that the ethical thing to do? But I always stress this part of that conversation. Remember that these are still businesses that are trying to run. And in light of that, you know, how much do you think, or do you believe, does one, not you, but does one believe that they're not going to think like a business, right? What is the expectation? And so I think expectation versus reality, sometimes that conversation can get a little blurry. But if you go into it understanding that, yes, these are sports that put their cars with all these logos in front of millions, billions of people, that's one thing. That's great. They're there to entertain. But in order for that to happen, they have to make money. It's a little bit easier to understand why certain decisions are made, if that can make any sense.
Yeah, completely. I think just to kind of bookend this topic, though, it's, you do have to wonder if anyone in Formula One could get sued by anyone for, you know, like I said, with the FTX, it's a perfect example. Like, what are their liabilities? And those are those ethical concerns that I think moving forward after this happened, that teams really do have to pay attention to. F1 in general has to pay attention to that. Look at the Miami Grand Prix. That is fronted by a crypto company. So it's, again, we talk about the ethics of F1 as they're trying to expand. And I think it's trying to prove viability beyond the Netflix fan base. Because it's one thing, Netflix could, you know, go defunct tomorrow. I mean, it won't, but it could. And at the end of the day, where would Drive to Survive reside? YouTube, any place else? But would it have the fan base that it has now? Would it have? I mean, I haven't watched Drive to Survive in a while, only because, again, for me, I know what happened during the season. I think it's just kind of talking about the drama that happened, you know, in the garages throughout the season. But again, when you're an F1 junkie, so to speak, you kind of know the drama, you know what's happened already. So it's, you know, it's entertainment, but at the same time, they're trying to find ways to keep those fans. Just because somebody starts a series doesn't mean they're going to finish it. So if you're trying to work on fan retention, I think every single component, including ethics, matters.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't have any more to add. I agree. I do have something to add. Actually, the sport is growing. Right, visibility is growing. There's more eyeballs on the sport, at least newer eyeballs on the sport in a changing time and world where, you know, and we talked a little bit about social media last week, but, you know, social media, it's very different than it was 20 or 30 years, 40, 50 years ago, right? So the speed as to which information or rumors, gossip, anything can go out there is like nothing else ever before. And so whether you're F1 or whether you're the White House or whether you are a company or a business, you have to take all of that into consideration. So yes, I agree. Ethics need to be considered. And, you know, maybe as we get, you know, further into this Liberty Media owned F1 and as social media continues to, you know, become more and more, you know, front and center in of pretty much everything that's going on, or content in general, then yeah, I think it'll start to affect decisions that teams make. And it's not going to be just like, hey, whoever's going to give me $50 million can get a logo on the car and call it a day. Right now it's like, well, yeah, that's great, but I can get $50 million from a company who's far less, you know, controversial than yours, you know, yes, that'll probably happen. It already is to some extent with some teams, but I don't think we're fully there yet.
Yeah, I think exclusivity is going to be a driver, and I think it's already happening, and you're going to hopefully find less problematic. But then again, FTX was an exclusive brand, or seen as an exclusive brand at the time. You had them dumping millions of dollars into politicians. You had that they had so much leverage and influence really all over the world. So, I mean, you know, we talk about the influence of these companies and maybe how they determine the exclusivity. So yeah, it's going to require, I think, more greater due diligence by these companies by these F1 teams in the future. But I also think that gives us a great segue into this next topic, which is Formula One gatekeeping. Is Stefano Domenicali a gatekeeper? What are your thoughts on GM Andretti situation?
I'm a little annoyed with what's going on, only because it seems like there's such it's just such a contrast between what the sport or what Liberty and F1 are doing and what they're saying. And so, like, you have, you know, I think the decision to go to Netflix and say we're going to do this documentary and to go all in the U.S., put a third race, and not just put a third race, a massive, massive paddock area and permanent location, you know, permanent structure that's going to, you know, showcase the sport for years to come. You've got the Miami Grand Prix, you've got, you know, and already you had Austin. To do things like that, and then at the same time not allow Andretti Cadillac, Andretti GM, whatever it's going to be called, in, is just weird to me. Now, I will say this. I do understand that you can't just allow anybody. You could, right? Anybody with the dollars could. And then you have to put a performance benchmark, right? 107%. You don't hit the benchmark, you can't start the race, right? But it just seems odd that publicly, so for those that don't know, Domenicali talked to, I think it was Sky Sports this past weekend or a couple days ago, whenever it was, and he made a comment that Andretti's are the ones that are being greedy, but he also made a comment saying that there are other teams that are interested or other folks interested in entering that are far less vocal, but are just as well equipped or what do you say, that are well equipped to enter and that are prepared, something along those lines, which I thought was interesting because he wants to make it clear that, hey, Andretti's not the only one, the only game in town here. They're not the only ones coming to us. We've got plenty of other people that are coming to us. Okay, cool. As you should, right? You're Formula One. But the fact that the Andretti entry is not, you know, I don't want to say automatic, but it's not like they don't have any experience. Yeah. Like we're talking about, they, you know, Andretti's got teams in almost every other, you know, type of motorsport series. And they've got Formula E, IndyCar, like, that alone should be enough to say, hey, we can at least give it a shot. And when you look at the performance of teams like Haas and Williams, again, I know people in both of those, no hate against them, just strictly performance on track. When you look at that, it's like, how do you not allow an entry that has a lot of potential? You know, again, it's not, nobody that enters a sport is going to be good year one. And maybe they, you know, maybe it could happen. You know, there's always those expansion teams that do well in, you know, in NFL or in baseball or whatever it might be. And it's like, you get lucky one year and maybe that'll happen, but realistically it won't. So there's already that understanding that any team that comes in is going to have an uphill climb.
Yeah.
So why, like, I only have questions. I don't know if I have any statements on it. It's more like, what is the point of gatekeeping a team, any team, if they have the money, like, and they've hit all of the requirements that you have set out? Why are the goalposts constantly moving? Why am I aiming for a different goal every time? It almost feels like they didn't expect, which this is a weird statement to make, but it almost is like they didn't understand or expect the full potential of what they were doing with their, you know, marketing blitz and with Netflix and all this other stuff, that it kind of like, it put them on their back heels now, where it's like, oh man, we don't want to open the sport up too easily. Like $200 million is not enough. That we, you know, I think Toto had made a comment around, well, it takes at least $1 billion to get a team running. So you need $600-700 million at least as an entry fee or as anti-dilution fee. And I don't know if that was just Toto that mentioned it or there was others, but again, I can't blame the other teams for wanting more money, right? Like, hey, we don't want to lose our cut. But at the same time, there's an agreement 2 years ago that said 200 million. So why is this changing now? And to hear that from the top of the series, you know, from Domenicali is definitely off-putting. If I'm Andretti, I stay in the fight. I keep going until I get through. But it every day that goes by, you have to feel like it's less and less likely for them to get in.
Yeah. Well, other teams have expressed that entry into F1 should be on par with entry into, say, the NHL. So if NHL expansion teams are willing to pay $500-600 million to join, then it should be no different for an F1 team, which is why a lot of teams have suggested that, you know, let's wait until another, you know, the Concorde Agreement is renegotiated. But I don't know that the sport can wait that long. And if they do decide to let some, you know, maybe hypothetically say Kia decides, oh, hey, we want to join F1. So they get some sponsorship, you know, some partnership going, and they're admitted on, you know, $200 million, but Andretti is snubbed, then I think we can pretty much determine why that was the cause, because Andretti GM has a lot of money behind them. They have a lot of power. They have a lot of experience behind them. And I think that one thing with Cadillac, I drive Cadillacs, and I can say that I think for a long time, Cadillac was kind of stagnant in terms of their performance. You didn't really see a lot of performance components. It was still kind of your grandpa's car in a way. And they started to look good. And then they kind of took away some models and then came back. And then you really see now there's this push, and you can see it in the Blackwing, that there's a push for Cadillac right now to start creating more performance vehicles that can compete with the likes of Mercedes. So you have to assume that there's some level of competition there. You wrote in Reed Qualifier that the FIA hasn't publicly committed to adding any teams, but I think going back into the Netflix effect, eventually people might stop watching that show. And how are you going to retain those fans beyond that? And so Liberty Media, you also said in Reed Qualifier, Liberty Media has expressed that popularizing the sport might require adding more teams. So you would think that with Andretti confident that a GM partnership is well suited for where Formula One is now, especially with that growth, you also have to take a look at GM's numbers. They overtook Toyota as the top automaker in the US in 2022. They sold almost 2.3 million units with a 3% year-over-year increase. So as rumors of a GM Andretti or a Cadillac Andretti partnership are heating up, I mean, sales are going up. And I'm not sure if they're mutually exclusive to each other. There probably is no direct correlation, but as F1 expands in America, it has to look at American automakers as an easy way, or rather an easier way, possibly, to lock in fans long-term. They've committed now to three big races. They've committed to Vegas. They're building out the infrastructure. We'll talk more about that later. But I think they have to think strategically. And if they can lock in the two biggest American automakers as a power unit partner, as a title sponsor, I think that's the way to go, because you have people like me who are diehard GM, diehard Cadillac fans who don't really want to buy anything else because, you know, it is sort of a legacy tradition. That's all my dad drove. That's all I drive. And there's a lot of other people like that out there who only exclusively buy one car brand. So if they have a partnership with an F1 team, with a globally recognized team, they're going to start looking at that and saying, I wonder how much of my car has contributed to the performance of an F1 team. And that, I think, is a badge of honor. I think you talk to a lot of Mercedes fans who own Mercedes, and a lot of them kind of have similar beliefs. They're like, I think it's really cool that my car is an F1 team, and they take pride in that. So I don't know. I think as F1 is looking to lock in long-term fans, they have to start looking at their commitment to America, and they need to stop gatekeeping in ways that are, I think, pretty obvious.
I you're talking about automakers in F1, and Ferrari had come out with their 22, their was it quarter four of 22 report came out, earnings report. Sorry, I was trying to say earnings report, right? And it wasn't the quarter. I think it was the full year report. I should pull it up, but I don't have it in front of me. Their profits jumped like 13%. And it was, I believe, their best year ever in terms of units sold. Now, obviously, Ferrari is very different than GM. They shipped 13,221 vehicles in 22. And like I said, the profits jumped 13%. They are a company that is driven by their racing product, speed. I mean, all the way back to Enzo Ferrari, like, they are defined by the racetrack. To me, this, their brand is so symbolic of F1 and what F1 Formula One does for a brand, or from what racing, motorsport in general, does for a brand, but specifically Formula One, because they don't sell something that anybody can buy. You know, it's not a car that you're going to find at any dealership, right? It's a car that is much higher end. Very specific person is going to be buying it. You have to have quite a bit of money to buy one, all of that. The fact that the profile is rising means that those folks are more interested in the brand. They're more interested in this brand than I don't know, Bugatti or you know, Aston Martin, even though Aston Martin's in Formula One, they're not as successful. So you have to think that that is directly correlated to any brand wanting to enter the sport. With that said, and combining with what you just mentioned about GM, when you're trying to break into the Americas and you're trying to become, you know, more US-centric, again, this is just such a damn no-brainer for them to let a GM, obviously Ford is now is back, but like this is just such a no-brainer. To me, there's no reason for this not to happen. It just makes so much. Think about this for a second. Every time you see an AMG Mercedes on the road, what do you think of? Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah, I was about to say that. You know what I think of now too? Think of the driving experiences that Mercedes AMG has, where they take them to, you know, do snow driving and different, you know, trips that they take. I know Carmen Munt, George Russell's girlfriend, has been on these trips, and she's shown videos, posted videos and photos of her driving these cars. And, you know, that's what I think of. And I think of fun and luxury and like all these just different experiences, and they're selling the experience.
Oh, it's awesome. Mercedes actually went the route of, you know, AMG used to be super exclusive. I had an AMG. I sold it last year. I had a beautiful twin turbo V8 AMG. And it was like every time I got in it and every time I stepped on the gas, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in a I'm not in a Formula One car, but I'm like, I'm in a Formula One car. Right. It was exciting. You started seeing a lot more AMGs on the road. I talked to someone at the one of the local AMG dealers or Mercedes dealers, and they were using the AMG badging a lot more. They were using a lot of the verbiage a lot more, AMG verbiage, because that was the mandate from Mercedes or whatever they were telling me was how they wanted to present themselves, right? Oh, AMG, it's upper echelon, right? It's not just a Mercedes, it's an AMG. Every AMG, every Mercedes on the road becomes a billboard for the team, or vice versa, right? Every time you see a car on the TV racing, it becomes a billboard for the brand. And so Mercedes said, well, we're going to, because we use the AMG branding heavily on the Formula One car, we're going to make sure that AMG branding, you see a lot more of that in the dealerships and on the cars and whatnot. This is like, to me, this is, I don't know if the light bulb just went off, but it's like every time you see a Cadillac on the road, if let's say you put Cadillac, you know, you allow this Andretti Cadillac entry, every time you see a Cadillac or a GM or a Ford or whatever it might be, it's a billboard for Formula One. It is so obvious, at least in my head, that I can't believe that there's not somebody within Formula One that's saying, yeah, we need to get this to happen. Like, this has to happen. It is the easiest low-hanging fruit for us. It is an absolute layup. Man, it's a billboard. Every Cadillac would become a billboard for Formula One at that point.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I could see Blackwing branding on the Cadillac Andretti, and it would be very similar to Mercedes AMG. And those Blackwings are sexy. They've got the racing seats. I mean, Cadillac needs to make it in a coupe for sure, or a coupe.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Can you imagine though, like seeing, you would see so many more Blackwings on the road. And I think that there would be a direct competition with Mercedes, you know, and I think it's more accessible. You know, not a lot of people can afford a Ferrari. And so you can't afford a Ferrari, but okay, I can afford a Mercedes AMG. I can afford a Cadillac Blackwing V. You have options. So again, if cash is the motivation behind the decisions being made, you know that Cadillac would have it in the bag.
Yeah.
It blows my mind that they're gatekeeping this. It just, like you said, it's such a no-brainer.
Speaking of, I guess, gatekeeping. We talked a little bit about the, you know, how does F1 keep these F1 fan or these Netflix era fans? I kind of mentioned it a little bit, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on what do they need to do right now? What's one or two things you think that can happen this season or just going forward in the short term for them to lock in that group of people, right? Generation Drive to Survive or Netflix era fans, whatever you want to call them. What do you think has to happen to lock them in?
I think they're doing it. I think they're allowing more access to fans than they ever have. They're giving more behind the scenes. They're sort of engaging more. I notice social media, their admins are all over different trends and they're very on top of that stuff. They're great at Reels. They're great at TikToks. They're great at all the things that I think keep that younger generation of fans interested. F1 is also really encouraging of content creators. Whereas in the past, I think that sports journalists, that they were the gatekeepers. As a former football journalist, I remember a period where you suddenly started having more people writing articles on blogs and posting on Twitter. And so many people who didn't go to college for journalism were suddenly getting the jobs that the journalists wanted. And they were mad, myself included. I was like, you know, again, with the elitism, like, you didn't go to school for this. What are you doing here? You know? And these people ended up having very successful careers in sports, and good for them. They managed to crack the code. But I love that F1 is encouraging of that. And I love that you have so many actual journalists who are embracing this culture of content creators, because I think content creators are forcing teams out of their comfort zones. They're forcing that old school F1 guardianship to kind of have to break its walls down and say, okay, if we want to be viable and successful, this is what we have to do. And it should be about the cars. It should be about the racing. But because of Drive to Survive, it opened up the floodgates to the drama. And as we know, we are a society driven by drama. So, and the FIA, F1, all their drama, they certainly don't help to quell this. They encourage it more than anything. So I think F1 is doing a good job engaging and keeping that fan base. I think in the long term, though, I'm not sure. We talked about social media on our podcast last week and how that's not going anywhere. It's still so young. And we think about how, remember our MySpace top 8, like you could always in real time in front of everyone, basically tell everyone who was on your shit list by who you would remove from your MySpace top 8. And we think about that and we're like, wow, that was such a long time ago. But, you know, is social media now really any different? It still embraces a lot of those sort of more primitive trends. Now it's like you break up with somebody, you delete all the photos. You know, so really, have we really changed our behaviors that much from when social media first became a thing? Not really. From the era of MySpace? Not really. Yeah. So I think we're adapting, we're evolving. And because we're so adaptive to things while also embracing the past in a lot of ways, you're engaging older audiences, you're engaging younger audiences. And I think as long as people feel like they have access, you shouldn't have a problem keeping your fan base. But again, that access goes to the expansion of F1 in the right ways. That goes to hosting races in cities that are conducive to that. That involves inviting teams that have built-in fan bases. And, you know, as this younger generation is getting older, they're going to be able to start affording the Cadillacs, the Mercedes, the things. And, you know, F1 better be ready for that.
Yeah. There's a level of, you know, you were talking about the admins. I want to give a shout out because I saw McLaren do something recently. You know, they're going through their 60th. It's their 60th anniversary. They were following a ton of different fans back on, at least this is Twitter, which I thought was really cool. And then because all those fans were like screenshotting it and sharing it and being like, oh my God, I just got followed by McLaren. Like, this is so cool. I mean, people went nuts for it. Right. And it's like you realize that it's like it's either a you know, it's somebody running that. It's not like McLaren is pushing follow, but whatever. It's still, it doesn't matter because that creates a connection. And I even saw today that McLaren had shared a creator that had interviewed one of their executives. They shared the content, which was really cool. But they also, they quote tweeted it and said something like, make sure you share Formula One or, you know, share motorsport creators, content creators that are out there every day creating great content. And I was like, you know what? That's so smart. It's a very small line that's going to get lost in the shuffle of tweets, right? Like the minute they tweeted something else, like that one was already forgotten about. But it means a lot to the folks that are doing this every day. I mean, even you and I, right? We're creating content for free for Formula One, essentially.
Yeah.
But I thought it was just a really cool thing for McLaren to do because it shows that they actually are at the very least listening. But I have noticed a shift in how, at least on social media, the teams are doing things. They're a lot more responsive. They seem to be almost like they're responding more to creators or to just users in general, even when it's not something that's like necessarily directed at them. So they're doing a lot more social listening, which is really important. And I think you nailed it. You know, that's how you lock in this group of people. You know, you let them know, hey, we're here. You're not going completely unnoticed. You know, if you remember when this group of folks started first coming into watching the sport, most of the teams were very aloof, not interested in engaging. It was like you could tweet at your favorite team a million times and you might get a like, or yeah, you might, you know, maybe they would respond to you one time. Now they're engaging. And like you said, it's trendy. It's funny. They're actually hitting on things that people are paying attention to and listening to and watching. The trends are hysterical. Especially like TikTok is such a trend. Is it such a tastemaker right now? And the teams that are using it and they're doing funny things on it, the drivers that are using it, like it makes me happy for the newer fan because it just like it lets them know, hey, we're not trying to totally ignore you. Like, thanks for coming in. We understand that this is how you enjoy this sport. You may not want to watch, you know, the cars go around a circle on the track, but you're going to totally engage with us and rock our merchandise and buy every bit of, you know, merchandise we put out there. So we're going to find a way to engage with you, even if it's not like at the actual track. Right. That's where we are. That's the reality of where we are right now, especially with, you know, with Formula One, is that there might be people that really don't care about the on-track product. And I know that's hard for purists to hear. It's hard for me to even say as someone who's watched Formula One most of my life, because to me, I believe in the product on the grid. Like, that's what I'm interested in. But there's so many people that just aren't, and you don't want to abandon that. And they're doing a good job. Let's see it continue. That's my thing. Like, I want to see it continue. Like, cool, you're doing it, but keep doing it.
Well, even to Ferrari's credit, I mean, we talk about accessibility. We talk about things that teams have that are at, you know, more accessible price points, et cetera. Even Ferrari has a line of handbags that are pretty much, I would say, on par with Prada, Louis, those high-end luxury brands. And, you know, say you don't really care necessarily about the brand, you want something that is luxury, something that is high quality, et cetera, and you're mm-hmm. a Ferrari fan and you say, well, I might not be able to afford yep. a Ferrari, but I can afford a handbag and I can wear that handbag proudly. So even Ferrari, to some extent, they have their merchandise, they have their handbags, they have their luxury items that are a draw to a lot of people who maybe, yeah, like they're from a vehicular standpoint, they're not in that price point yet, but they also yeah. feel like they're not being forgotten about by yeah. a brand. And that goes a long way with a lot of these people that can't afford AMG, Mercedes AMGs, but they can afford a hat that says Mercedes AMG on it. And absolutely. That even that little hat, that $60 hat, makes them feel good.
So there's a thought process behind all of this. And I don't have to get too deep into it, but there's a whole like human behavior thought process behind things like Ferrari's products, AMG, Porsche, and the products they sell that aren't their cars. It's it creates a sense of community when, like you said, most people can't afford the car. Let's face it. There's only, 13,000 Ferraris that shipped last year. That's not nearly enough to blanket the world in that brand. But how else do you reach everywhere? How do you get into the households of everybody, even if they don't have their car, your car in their garage? Well, like I'm sitting next to you, I've got a Ferrari espresso cup next to me. I have a Ferrari flag behind me. I've got a Ferrari water cup in front of me. I've got a keychain, a phone case, all this stuff, right? There's another way to reach the masses without cheapening the brand itself, right? So what do? They make high-end, like you said, bags or high-end pens. I just saw that Ferrari and Mont Blanc are coming out with a $1,900 pen, right? It's not a Bic pen that you buy at the store. It's a $1,900 Mont Blanc. McLaren Tumi. I actually have one of their bags. Someone got it for me as a gift, even though it was McLaren. They just thought it was like Formula One, and they were like, "This is so cool!" And I got it as a gift, a duffel. That's like an $1,100 bag. It's a carbon fiber Tumi bag with McLaren papaya accents on it and whatnot. Not everyone can buy a McLaren, but I can go buy. Well, some people can go and buy, that Tumi bag and be like, "Oh, look, I've got like a piece of McLaren on me," right? I think we're gonna see a lot more of that at better price points as well, as we continue down this road where teams understand that merch can be more than just like throwing a driver's name and number on a shirt, right, or a jersey, like in the NFL or NBA or other sports. Insert other sports here. They can truly be a lifestyle piece. And that's where that's what differentiates the good brands versus the ones that kind of like are just getting by, is when you become a lifestyle, part of the lifestyle conversation. Like I said, Porsche's always done that. Ferrari's always done that really well. And you'll see that. I truly believe you'll see a lot more of that with Formula One teams understanding that there's a whole lifestyle and culture and subculture behind each one of these teams and their fans. Like if you tap into that, you win. Even if these people can't afford to go to races or afford to buy your car, they can still be proponents and they can still be billboards for you, without the vehicle.
Yeah. I think it's, again, when you're trying to gatekeep in Formula One, I think it should be more about fan protection. It should be more about brand protection. You're trying to protect yourself from opportunistic brands that maybe don't align with you ethically. I think that's where F1, that's where these teams should be gatekeeping, not in terms of offering product and, that sort of community availability to their fan base. And I think that F1, we talk about how does F1 retain the Netflix fan base? That's exactly how you do it. You make them feel like they're like a part of the culture. And you don't do that by abandoning people. And I think that's where F1, that's where a lot of major sports have been able to be successful. I think you hear more complaints now in a lot of the major sports because these games have become very expensive. The concessions are expensive. The jerseys are expensive. Things are more expensive than people are used to them being. And as a result, a lot of people have said, "Well, I'm not going to games." Well, by and large, it's still relatively affordable to most people to go to these games, especially if you say, "Okay, we're only going to one game a year. Let's go all out." But I think that F1, if you're not, again, with the ticket prices, people, that's their biggest complaint right now, is that ticket prices are going up, that hotel prices have gone up. I think one night in Austin was $1,200, $1,300 a night at most of the local hotels. So as the actual races, as things are becoming more expensive, again, you have to be able to give people options to feel like that's part of the community. And I think that F1 is doing a masterful job of that. And, we can continue to go on for days about fan retention. that's how you do it. And I think that also offering a better product, and I think this can go into kind of our last segment on F1 Las Vegas. And who doesn't love Vegas? My parents had a house in Lake Tahoe for 14 years. I can't tell you how many times I went to Las Vegas because it was right there and it was so much fun. It's a rite of passage in America, practically, when you turn 21, although in the UK you can drink legally when you're 18. But I think that that is part of that American experience that is going to attract a lot of foreign fans. And there's a lot of people that said from abroad that have said, if there is a race that I'm really interested in going to now, it's that Vegas race, because as they see it, Monaco is inaccessible. Monaco is just exclusive. You can't step foot in Monaco during race week there. It's just way too expensive for people. So if you want that same high profile exclusive experience, you're now targeting Las Vegas. So
Vegas.
I was just going to ask, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Vegas, you know, and this will be a topic of conversation, I think, for probably until we go to that race, right? We'll probably be talking about it on every show, maybe not, but on a lot of shows until it actually happens. I guess I'm trying to formulate how I want to say this, but yes, somewhat of a rite of passage. I guess it just depends on where you grew up and whatnot. But yes, I think a lot of people in the U.S. look at Vegas as like this, oh my God, I got to go to Vegas at least once in my life, right? I've got to have that experience. I've got to see the bright shining lights and the, you know, the shows and how big the casinos are and things like that. And it's just a whole different world, right? Like the Las Vegas Strip itself is just it's this thing in the desert that was built, right? If you really think about it, it was popped up out of nowhere. It's in the middle of nowhere, at least it was back in, you know, the 50s or whatever, and it pops up out of nowhere, and it kind of, I don't know, it almost like kind of represents the whole flow of racing in Vegas for Formula One, right? Just kind of like popped up out of nowhere again, and it just happened, or it's happening again, but it was like fast track this time around. They get, and I did this research a while back for, I don't even remember the reason. I was looking up, I think I had a client that was a tourism focused client, and we were looking at the numbers or the percentages of folks that go to Vegas, and outside of the U.S., outside of U.S. travelers, the U.K., again, at this time, I haven't looked up new numbers, brand new numbers, but this is still fairly recent. It was a little bit pre-pandemic, so it might be a little bit different now, but the U.K. sent the highest number of folks to Vegas. So there's definitely like an interest there, right? And Europeans... this is a general statement, but Europeans do like American culture, or are interested in American culture. Let's put it that way. And I'll speak from my experience, you know, with family that I have in Italy and talking to them. I mean, a lot of things, they're very interested in America, right? They're very interested in what's going on in America. They're very interested in, you know, our clothes, our fashion, our pop culture. This is no different, right? Vegas becomes no different for the rest of the world. Yes, if you read Twitter, you would think that everyone hates Vegas. Oh, I hate Vegas. I'm not going to Vegas. It's just for the rich. It's just for the... Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it's going to be a very corporate-like event. Maybe it's going to be an event that's focused, you know, for the rich. But you know what? If you check the same Twitter, you don't see people complaining, at least Europeans, complaining as much about Monaco, which was no different. It's just as exclusive. And of course, there's always back and forth there. But Vegas becomes a true spectacle for the sport to every potential of that word. You're going to have spectacle on and off the track. You're going to have crazy, outrageous things happening. You know, the Bellagio fountains going off as cars are flying down the strip. I mean, first of all, for those that don't know Vegas or know the logistics of Las Vegas, the strip being shut down, that's huge. I don't know any, and maybe you could tell me better. Maybe you're more familiar with it. I don't know of the strip being shut down. Like I can't remember other events that were this, as you know, hyped up as Formula One is, that shut down the strip.
I know the strip has been shut down for movies, for production elements, mm-hmm. but I know it was going to be shut down for the NFL draft, at least at some capacity. Obviously, I believe that was during COVID. And that was pared down significantly, so it wasn't as problematic. Yeah. But I think you can liken Las Vegas to Dubai, or liken Dubai to Las Vegas, in terms of how it just kind of popped up in the desert out of nowhere. Now it's just this magical place.
Good call.
I think that's the comparison there. And I think that's why people are so attracted to Dubai. And that's maybe why people are so attracted to Las Vegas, in terms of just maybe what it has to offer. I will say that Las Vegas in the last maybe 10 years or so has really upped its game, which is why it's so important to highlight why F1 Las Vegas is so important. Because when you look at the real estate that F1 bought, and this isn't a promoter that bought it, this is F1. Mm-hmm. They are fully committed that they bought a very, very exclusive, highly coveted piece of property that some casino, some, you know, hotel magnate would have loved to have acquired.
Yeah.
Especially with every single thing that Las Vegas is starting to pump into its infrastructure right now. Mm-hmm. The fact that F1 bought that speaks volumes in terms of its commitment to Las Vegas. And so, you know, I think that people can say, well, I hate this race. I think this is the worst thing that could have happened, et cetera, et cetera. I don't like Las Vegas. I think it's seedy. I think it's this. I think it's that. Well, imagine the tourism dollars that that's going to bring to the Las Vegas economy. Las Vegas is marijuana friendly. Las Vegas is a place where you go and gamble and you enjoy fine dining and you enjoy nightlife and you enjoy these, you know, exquisite clubs that overlook the Las Vegas Strip. And there's just music coming at you from every single direction. And the fact that they are shutting down the Strip without really any pushback because of all of the properties that are involved. Right now, you're talking founding partners in Caesars, MGM, the Wynn, Resorts World, the Venetian, et cetera. You're not getting pushback because all of them are able to essentially have a lawn party, a garden party, and create these massive structures, charge whatever they want to, for people to watch this race, knowing that people are going to pay for it. At the Cosmopolitan, you have half the casino, half the hotel that has balconies that are facing the strip, those beautiful Bellagio fountains, imagining drivers, you know, these incredible cars racing down that. Just the visual of all of this is exactly what you imagine when you think of Las Vegas. And so I think this is a great question. My best friend actually asked this question. She lives in Las Vegas and she said, I'm curious to know more about the path to construction for the track, how the strip is going to shut down, all the behind the scenes stuff that goes into building an F1 brand in Las Vegas. And I think those are great questions. And especially as someone who lives there, these are all, I think, necessary concerns that they have. What have you heard about that construction, logistics, et cetera?
Yeah, so I'll add to what you were just talking about. Let me just piggyback off of it. Not only is there so much faith in Vegas, but the Clark County Commission actually. So the race is only locked in for 3 years. The Grand Prix has been like 3 years is what they've talked about. But the Clark County Commission actually approved a vote to recognize the Grand Prix for the next 10 years. So they're saying, we might only have like a 3-year deal going on, but we know this is going to be a long-lasting partnership. And the Clark County Commissioner said, we have a three-year contract with Formula One, but we anticipate a lifetime in partnership. This will open the pathway to be able to do it for at least 10 years and then beyond that. I'm sure those who succeed us will see the value in what we've done and continue doing it forever. So they they voted on this and said, we get this. We understand what's happening here and what this will do. We want to lock it in for at least 10 years. So if Formula One wants to re-up the contract, Vegas doesn't have to go back and like reapprove, or Clark County doesn't have to go back and reapprove anything. It's all, we recognize this as a massive event and its importance. So that's just to, piggyback off of that, like that there's a lot to be said for those types of things. Like that doesn't happen for any event that comes around. And again, this event is going to make a massive, massive impact, economically for the area. They're estimating upwards of $1 billion. Not even the Super Bowl is estimated to do that. And the Super Bowl is the largest sporting event in the United States, singular sporting event in the United States. It's actually quite incredible. And it's fascinating when you just hear those things and you take them in for a second. Going on to what your friend asked you, I don't know. I haven't heard. I haven't tapped in too much about logistics. I did hear that they're going to do it's going to take like a 5-day setup period. So each week, every week for the next 3 years, whatever it is, before the race, before that Thanksgiving holiday, they will, I think they're talking about set up a few hours a day for 5 days leading up to the race. So, they're not just going to all of a sudden shut down the strip and that's it. It'll be little by little to keep things going. That's also a very busy time of year in Vegas. So that's quite interesting to see that they're going to do it in like a staggered way, but at least they believe, they meaning the, commission, the officials there believe that they're not going to completely disrupt everything for like an entire week or two. So that'll be quite fun to watch and follow. That's really, I really haven't heard much of anything else. I mean, I've seen videos and flyovers of the paddock area they're building on the land, but that doesn't really interfere with anything that I know of right now. I mean, there's not much more than that. And if there is something and someone's listening to this podcast and knows more, like, please feel free to reach out and say, hey, this is what's actually happening. I would love, I'd love to know. We'd love to hear it, and we'll definitely feature it on the, on the podcast. But we're Vegas being the biggest thing happening this year in Formula One, we'll definitely be paying attention to it.
Yeah. Well, I did hear a couple of things that, in conjunction with the founding partners, when you think about the actual logistics of opening and closing the strip, it's going to be a lot easier because they're going to essentially be in partnership. So they're not going to have as big of a problem with F1 closing the strips. That's going to impede business, because we know that's not going to be the case. That's kind of going to become the epicenter for F1. That's going to become a city within a city that week. And most of the events are going to be occurring in this, that general strip area. I imagine they're probably going to do some helicopter tours, some, aerial shots, et cetera, capturing other things to, maybe help promote tourism. But I imagine the majority of this stuff is going to happen on the strip, which might be unfortunate if somebody is maybe staying out in Red Rock or something, kind of off the strip, but I'm sure they won't have an issue getting to the strip necessarily. Everyone knows when you go to Vegas, there's a ton of walking involved. So if you're going to the race and you're listening to this, just, make sure to pack comfy shoes. That's my suggestion. Don't wear high heels everywhere you go. You're going to die. Mm-hmm. I've been there. Yep. And pack flats in your purse. That is a huge pro tip of Las Vegas. But the infrastructure, one thing that's really interesting is that we talked about the infrastructure that F1 purchased to build the paddock. That's a permanent paddock. So it makes things significantly easier when you talk about the breakdown and the building of the actual race infrastructure. And one of the top project managers, I think his name is Oliver Legions. Somebody, please correct me if I'm butchering that, but he's worked on some of the top races, including the U.S. Grand Prix in Austin, Mexico City, and others. So he knows from street circuits to dedicated tracks. He's pretty, you know, well known with logistics. And he said that the biggest logistical issue will be the circuit off the strip. It's not necessarily closing down the strip. It's going to, you know, be the most problematic. Cause like I said, you have those founding partners that kind of, they understand that that's going to be a city within a city that week. But I've heard that they're going, I mean, obviously we know they're going to have to keep the roads open really until quali. I think during quali is when you kind of have to make sure that the roads are safe. Obviously I think that's going to happen a couple days prior to that. And one thing that they're really going to have to do is monitor those streets, because anyone who's ever been to Vegas, you know, there's a lot of commercial trucks going in and out all day. And when that happens, you're susceptible to potholes. Anyone who has ever lived in a major city, they know that. Even in downtown Austin, I can't imagine racing in downtown Austin with the amount of potholes that there are. So that's something that F1 is going to have to continue monitoring, that the city of Las Vegas is going to have to continue monitoring to make sure that those aren't issues, because that could mess up your entire chassis. But the good news is Las Vegas, from what I've heard, they're dedicated to making this as seamless as humanly possible. But I obviously, we know that nothing is ever seamless at any race. So I think expect this to not be seamless, expect there to be some level of problems. But I think the revenue, I hope the revenue, and this, again, we talked about in the last podcast, what this is going to stimulate in terms of the economy. This is going to help small business owners and major corporations alike, in that hopefully the revenue that's generated from the Las Vegas Grand Prix is able to calm residents and their anxieties. Because when they're thinking about this, they're thinking of all the streets that are going to have to be shut down for this race. And that's going to create some serious traffic problems for people in Las Vegas. There's only so many streets in and out. And there's a lot of people that live in Las Vegas and who work on the strip too, who are going to have to get to work some way or another. So like I said, hopefully the revenue that's generated helps to kind of calm those anxieties. But I mean, it's going to be, I think the logistics and how this race actually goes off is going to be something to monitor for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's all we've got today.
Yeah. We covered quite a bit today. And I think that, you know, there is so much changing. The season's, you know, we're getting into the closer to the start of the season. There will surely be things that we want to cover each week that we may not get to, but we will be sure to deliver you that information at some point. So while we may not always have the latest information, we're definitely going to have the information that the two of us want to dive into and kind of sink our teeth into a little bit deeper. That's what I enjoy the most. And I know you do as well, where it's like, hey, I'm not here just to regurgitate the news. I'm here to actually sink into a topic and give my thoughts and kind of go back and forth and ideate about things. So I enjoy talking about this stuff. I could literally talk about it all day long.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree. You know, I think that this podcast, we didn't want it to be like any other content that you guys hear online, and who knows what this is going to turn into, but I think we're really enjoying what we've got so far. But if you guys have any questions, if you guys have any, like I said, comments, concerns, I know I posted, or not posted, but I said something sarcastically last week that I don't respond to people's messages. I'm going to get better at that. I promise. That's just part and parcel of content creation, right?
You don't have a choice. You have to respond. If we're doing this together, you have to represent both of us well.
I know. This isn't just passive social mediaing anymore. This is kind of a thing now, and we're excited about this. So for sure, if you guys have any comments, questions, concerns, etc., you guys can find me on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is at @VVFCastroVincenzo. You want to plug all your places people can find you?
Yeah, just Vincenzo Landino on Twitter is the easiest place to find me. And you can subscribe to my newsletter. It's readqualifier.com. It's where I talk a little bit deeper about this kind of stuff, almost the exact same thing, minus maybe the political, but I'll probably start tapping into that a little bit more as well to kind of piggyback off the show. And I mean, I'm very responsive. That's almost to a fault. So you can count on me.
And he has a child, and Vincenzo has a child too. So that says a lot about him as a person. So
I do. I do.
Well, that's all we've got today. Catch you guys next week.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for tuning into the VF1 show. If you liked it, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And for previews of next week's show, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at the VF Castro and Vincenzo Landino.